Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Greetings from the hill country of Central Texas. This is the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast.
All right. Welcome back to Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We got Mike Kaufman back again with us today, who just got back from another trip to Ukraine. So excellent time to have Mike back. And then we're also going to talk through a paper that he recently published along with Franz Stefangatti on they published in Survival Journal here recently. So Mike, I know, hyper busy person, so thank you very much for giving me a few minutes of your time.
Sure, happy to do it and happy to be back on your podcast.
All right, so hey, wanted to get started here on this paper that you guys published. I thought it was terrific. It's a topic that few people want to touch, and it's something that's incredibly important. So the name of the paper is Making Attrition Work, a Viable Theory of Victory for Ukraine. And in the paper, you and Franz talk about how attrition is it's in the title, it's a viable theory of victory for Ukraine. And it runs against what the West and the United States in particular have pushed Ukraine to adopt for most of the war. And so why is it based off you and Franz's research that is a viable theory of victory for Ukraine in this war so far?
Right. Well, so first, just say, you tend to sit where you stand. And coming at this, I've long held the belief that large-scale conventional wars, the ones that go beyond the initial period of war, they become much more like a marathon rather than a race. And so they have a tendency to come down to attrition and reconstitution, right? Replacement of manpower, material, ammunition, and defense industrial mobilization. I'm sorry to everyone who loves decisive battles. Yes, they're a factor too. But once you get past those first couple of months of a war, and it's clear that neither side is able to deal with the other side and knock out a blow, in the initial resolution, the initial operation, it ends up being much more marathon that comes down to these issues. So no surprise, the issues you do end up dealing with a lot are, manpower, material, and reconstitution of the force. And keep in mind, on top of that, due to the attrition suffered, you lose the army you started the war with. So whatever operational concepts you may have had, whatever your force may have been able to do, there's a good chance they will not be able to do that by year two of the war. And if you're operating under the assumptions that they can, you're going to lose a lot of the quality in your force. And the parts that are the hardest to replace are the people, because equipment can be rebuilt. New equipment can be made even better than what you started the war with. But people are hard to replace, especially good people. And you'll be pressed to do them while managing your losses and sort of sustaining the force on the line. Okay. Now to get into this conversation, why attrition? So let's be clear. A lot of people don't like attrition. And they want to find ways to avoid it. And I don't blame them. But while we talk about attrition as a sort of viable theory of success, for a very straightforward reason. First, The other approaches have tried and they failed. The theory of the case was tested last year on what a maneuver-based offensive could do with the level of preparation and execution that Ukrainian forces could muster with Western support and Western equipment. And it was unsuccessful. Okay. Mm-hmm. So first, let's not get into this conversation as though we haven't tried the other theories we have and they didn't work. All right. So now how about this theory that seemed less attractive, but increasingly looks like the one that can actually be made to work, or at the very least holds a better prospect of it. When we say attrition, first we have to kind of explain a little bit what we mean. And essentially that by attrition, we mean, you will like this, Amos, based on your writing as well, a destruction-centered approach, right, that results in high levels of attrition, reducing an enemy's capacity to fight by inflicting higher losses in personnel and material, the one's own side of suffering. This tends to privilege firepower over mobility and direct attack or a prepared defense over flanking actions and things of that nature, okay? Yeah. And we're basically saying, like, look, attempts at maneuver against the prepared defense have consistently floundered on both sides, both demonstrated by Russian offensives and by Ukraine offensives, okay? It's not just Ukraine we're talking about. Russia's had huge problems with us too, and especially in the absence of a decisive force advantage. And when we say, yes, maneuver is still relevant on the battlefield, but needs a lot of help from attrition to bear fruit. And since Ukraine certainly does not hold any of the advantages this year, it's disadvantage on manpower. It's very much disadvantage on ammunition. It's also disadvantage on equipment. It does not hold the initiative along most of the front line. Anybody who's arguing for anything other than attrition-based approach, leveraging prepared defense and the advantages that provides, I don't know what war you're following if you have a different theory of the case. Right? No, just being very frank. And to be clear, we also argue extensively for an expanded strike campaign, right? Not as a war-winning theory of its own, but again, to do what? To inflict attrition on Russian state capacity to sustain the war and create challenges on that front. Again, an attritional approach, right? And as you see, actually, an expanded strike campaign, for example, against Russian energy infrastructure, refining capacity, diesel distillation, what have you, these things can have an effect. But yeah, getting back to the issue at hand, so the reason why it's straightforward. First, it's easier to defend than to attack in land warfare. No new findings I think I'm making here in the last 4,000 years of conflict. Second, I'm just being very upfront. I don't want to paint anything that I'm arguing here as a new discovery. Second, okay, when you're disadvantaged across all these fronts, your best bet is to inflict the maximum attrition on the enemy force. Why? Because we assess, first, Russian military has constraints, for example, in force generation, particularly on the equipment side, and how much equipment they can put into the field. And if their victories are costly, for example, the latest battle in Avdiivka, which took 5 months, but if you look at the cost on the Russian side, up to 700 armored fighting vehicles, they basically spent an entire combined arms army's worth of kit, all right? So Russia can only afford a few offensives like that per year, which means Ukraine does have a decent prospect of holding Russian forces to incremental gains if they focus on attrition and exhausting Russian offensive potential at the peak of their defense spending. Now, people think the Russian military capacity is just going up. That's not actually the case. First of all, most equipment Russia spends is actually taken out of storage, more than 80%, and it's eating through its Soviet inheritance, the Soviet legacy. Second, Western production of ammunition is actually increasing significantly and will look a lot better at the end of this year than it does now. So Ukraine's prospects relative to Russia's prospects actually look a lot less dim as we enter 2025, as long as nobody tries another maneuvers-based offensive again. I'll just say that because...
It's game-changing. It's the war-winning thing to do.
I'm just saying, assuming that the goodness that's left in the Ukrainian military is not expended in another offensive with very few prospects of success on the base of an approach that's consistently failed to deliver, as long as that doesn't happen, well, I suppose it can deliver if the force on the other side is dramatically attrited, as happened in Kharkiv, where Russian manning levels were barely 25% and there were no defensive lines. So, yes, it can deliver in those circumstances, but those conditions do not exist, and they're not going to exist. Then Ukraine stands a chance at attriting the Russian military. There are people who disagree with that. There are plenty of folks in Ukraine that have an adage, and they say, look, a small Soviet army cannot beat a large Soviet army. And I would say, okay, it's a way people talk about it, and I hear this all the time. I say, okay, that might be true, but let me insert a couple caveats, or at least maybe minor disagreements. First, neither the Ukrainian military or the Russian military are Soviet armies. If anything, the Russian military is a cosplay Soviet military with some trapped in Soviet.
Yeah.
So one thing the Soviet military could do actually effectively is employ forces at large scale. That was one of the two big things that the Soviet military was supposed to do. The first one was mobilize a tremendous amount of manpower, and the second is employ it on a large scale. Tactically, not that brilliantly or particularly well, but quantity had a big quality of its own when you use it at scale, right? This is what the Soviet military was all about. The Russian military cannot do that right now. Its actual capacity to operate at scale is very limited. So is Ukraine's, that we've discussed before. And because of that, it can be held to incremental gains if the right approach is taken. The Ukrainian military is also not the Soviet army. I'm sorry. That's just not the case. Both militaries have inherited a degree of Soviet legacy and force structure, but neither of them are Soviet militaries. They're both force in transition. And lastly, yes, a small Soviet army cannot beat a large Soviet army. That is true. But Ukraine has stayed in this fight, not just because of its will, but substantially because of Western material assistance. And if it was just up to Ukraine's will, I am sorry, and I'm going to say this very bluntly, it's clear to me and many folks in Ukraine that they would have lost this war some time ago. It is Western equipment, ammunition, direct intelligence support, and a long list of other things that's helped keep Ukraine in the fight. So it's not just Ukraine. Okay, so stop there. But basically lay out the theory and to say it's not just about how Ukraine is doing. It's very much looking at where the two sides are potentially likely to be heading towards the end of this year into 2025. And much is going to be decided in the next couple of months because, and I'll maybe tee up this next question for you.
Yeah.
If you're interested, the main issues Ukraine is dealing with is manpower, fortifications, and ammunition. We know a lot about the munitions because much of that depends on us. Fortifications, they are finally starting to build, and there's a nationwide fortifications plan being implemented. And manpower is the big issue. And guess what? No surprise, it's coming down to the fundamentals. The things that you would expect to see in a prolonged war of attrition are the primary issues that are the deciding factors.
I think it's important to note, too, as I've gone back and done some additional writing on some things. So I had a War on the Rocks paper on attrition that came out not too long ago. And then there's a spinoff of that that's in the works also in another publication. But I was going back and doing some reading, and then you had a paper in, I think, 2021 at Modern War Institute on attrition. And I had forgotten that you had published that. And I was, you know, like it warmed my heart because I was like, you know, there's only a couple people here that are actually saying this idea is not a bad thing. And that's what I think folks forget is that just because you say attrition is useful doesn't make you an attritionist, right?
Right.
And understanding the utility of ideas and concepts, I think, as an analyst or as just a, you know, any whatever term it is that it is you do, whether you're a practitioner, an analyst, a scholar, whatever the case may be, understanding the utility of an idea is what we all need to be doing, and not just casting something aside because we think it's bad, you know. And I think that's just so silly, and so, you know, like I wanted to mention that because I was, you know, when I was going back and doing that research for that paper, I had come across that, and I was like, oh man, I feel like there's been like only a handful of people that have actually been writing about attrition in a not even a positive light, in a useful light for a couple of years, you know. And so I think it's also important to note too, I was having a conversation with a buddy of mine a couple of days ago. We were talking about some of the things that you just mentioned, the regeneration aspect of wars of attrition, right? And he was like, you know, we invest all this money and time and things into training and education, right? We try and generate this really great army. And then, you know, you go throw it into this fight, and then it ends up, you know, in the case, like in this war, you know, the army that goes into, on both sides, that goes into this conflict is completely gone at this point. And he was like, you know, it's like the guy that's working at Walmart that gets drafted is the guy that ends up winning winning the war, you know?
Yep. And, actually, yes. I usually use 7-Eleven as my analogy, but when I say, like, if you look at, you know, the people that are fighting the war, it's folks that were mobilized, maybe they were picked up outside of 7-Eleven, but yeah, it's the people you see on the street.
And it's almost, and again, it was just an interesting conversation, you know, where you talk about the value of training and education and all these things that we do. And we talk, you know, in the U.S. particularly, and Western militaries, we talk about, you know, this readiness being this huge thing. But really, like, readiness evaporates in these wars of attrition almost overnight, you know. And then it's shoestring readiness, you know, it's pickup ball readiness. It's how quickly can you get something from the port to the front, you know, where it's needed. And so I just, you know, your comments are interesting on that. And so with that, I think I guess the last point, I thought it was funny when you said Russia can throw a couple field armies into big battles a couple times a year, you know, like it's just something you never hear today, you know. They don't mind flushing a couple field armies down the toilet a couple times a year.
Yeah, well, so I was having this conversation last week in another setting with some colleagues, and we were discussing kind of the rough balance of casualties and Russian total casualties. And I was saying that, you know, just sort of off back of the envelope calculations, the total casualties for the Russian military can easily range, you know, 300,000 to 400,000, if you include, you know, killed in action, wounded in action, all that. With maybe an unrecoverable rate on the wounded of, who knows, 40-50%. But, and these casualties to any colleague here in the U.S. listening to these casualties sound astronomical. And I told them, one thing you have to be careful of and cautious with is that military culture is often formed by those historical experiences, those wars that the military looks to and sees as inherently formative, not to be tautological about it. And so for our military, the wars we look to that we're seen by those in the current armed forces as formative are not wars with very high levels of casualties of that sort. Whereas for the Russian military, the wars they typically reflect on are wars like World War II, in which losses of this size are barely one campaign. I got to be very honest with you. The entire total casualties for the Russia-Ukraine war to a military that sort of intellectually, in terms of its heritage, looks back to wars like World War II. Now, keeping in mind, of course, that world wars by definition are anomalous events. Why I always get frustrated with world war analogies. We call them world wars because they are outliers as historical events in the study of warfare, right? And war studies. Yeah. But be that as it may, I'm just saying that to that military, this loss rate is very significant, but it is actually comparable in terms of expectations, which your expectations are based on the wars you look to. And this has always been a bit of a distance or a refrain that I've heard when talking to our own folks in the military, who basically would look at Russian casualties and look at the force. Amos, and I often ask this over the last 2 years, well, how can they go on? And I would sort of look at them quizzically and say, why? I mean, why do you think that they can't? I mean, if you look, Russia contracted several hundred thousand personnel last year to fight for money and to join this military and to join assault groups in the military for more money, where you're quite likely to get killed, and is able to keep going and keep doing this. And it just shows a bit of our lack of appreciation of other countries, particularly other major powers, ability to reconstitute, ability to sustain very high levels of losses, ability to regenerate their forces, and ability to keep going in a war, even though they failed an initial operation in the initial invasion. And it's very important that people wrap their heads around this, because we know most major powers go into wars thinking that they're going to be short. Yep. Usually they end up being wrong. Usually they lose the better part of their initial force in that first period of war. Okay. Then they start thinking about how to sustain the war as much more of like a marathon and start getting into issues of reconstitution, industrial capacity. And then the people who are, let's say, are not attritionists, but those annoying people who are talking about these issues and attrition and how to manage all these things, suddenly their ideas don't look as bad. Yeah. Yeah, that's what people start turning them and say, hold on, What? Tell me more about the theory of how we could attrit the other opponent over time, because that's looking a bit better than the decisive battle thesis. Now that the decisive battle thesis isn't doing much for us at the moment.
It's so funny too. The other day there was two things that came out at MWI that had something to the effect of winning the first battle in the title. And I'm like, you know, like, why is this still an idea? This idea of first battles just needs to die, because it's so outside of any kind of like rah-rah, you know, cheerleading aspect, like that, the relevance of that is almost nil on any kind of war outcome, you know, ever, you know? And so it's... Go ahead.
Amos, by the way, you got to know your audience. The U.S. Army does not have a great track record of winning the first battle.
I always like to point at, like, you know, like Friedendahl and North Africa in the Second World War, you know, like that was an excellent example of that. We don't win first battles. But again, if you go back to the marathon analogy, as somebody that bonked on their first marathon, I fully appreciate your analogy, because I went out running my first 10 miles at a really, really fast pace. And by mile 13, I was like, you know what? I think I may be done. And by mile 14, I stopped and called my wife and said, come pick me up. I appreciate that analogy. All right. So with that, we'll transition to the next question. So you just got back. You mentioned a couple things. I'd like to also tie in leadership to those points that you highlighted too, and also ask with the I don't think sacking is the right term, but with the transition of Zaluzhny out of office, there is the head of the armed forces. What leadership adjustments, challenges, changes have you seen within the conflict since you went and came back from the last time that you went and came back to Ukraine?
Yeah, leadership's important, but what matters from my point of view is, you know, the team that somebody brings them with them. In Ukraine, the leadership change from Zaluzhny to Sirsky as commander-in-chief, what it really means in practice is Sirsky's brought in an entire new team in the general staff. It means a reshuffle of senior military leadership across key posts and those who are in charge of services. It also means some degree of change in the brigade commander jobs across some brigades. I anticipate that as well, and I've seen a few of them already. And also means a restructuring the military, and all that is yet to come. So the honest answer is that change is big, not because you're changing people. That's what folks focus on. I'm like, don't focus on the one person being changed. One person is just one person. They got the same 24 hours in the day as you do. Yeah. And usually they can be managed to death by meetings and briefings and going, you know, from one part of the battlefield to another. So what really matters is their style of management, right? Yep. First, foremost. Second, do they bring any new and different ideas? And third, all the people they bring with them. That's what matters, because you're replacing an entire command. You're replacing an entire chain of command, not just one person. So that's still in progress in Ukraine, and I don't think they're done with the personnel changes. And I think it's still very early to tell anything about how it's going to affect the war. What I do see is definitely a change in leadership style. Sirsky is much more hands-on. He travels the front line with Umerov, the Minister of Defense. And he is much more into the nitty-gritty of the tactical situation. I'll definitely say that. I'm not going to go too far into my kind of views on it. Everybody has their own views on what a four-star is best off doing or not. So... it's very much subject to your opinion, and I have my own views on that subject. But I will say that I see definitely a big difference in style from Zaluzhny, and also a significant difference in the management approach and in the people who have been brought in. But this is very early days. And last point on this, they inherited a house on fire, a front line that was buckling, and Avdiivka, and a series of Russian offensive operations. And Sirsky's focus has been to stabilize the front line, which they're working on now. There's still a slow moving retreat from Avdiivka taking place. But to fix the situation, and the situation they inherited is one where there is a critical deficit of manpower that needs to be addressed, fortifications that had not been built that are now being built very rapidly, but they are months behind that as an issue, right? Like they're, I think they're very much getting on top of it, but meaning there are no well-prepared secondary lines to retreat to, okay, or tertiary lines or what have you, right? And a significant deficit of ammunition, obviously in large part because of decreased Western support. I think they're dealing with a common fires asymmetry of around 5-1 or 6-1. But adding to that is the increased Russian use of glide bombs as a suppression and saturation weapon. The volume of glide bomb attacks has increased since I was there in November. And they're being done at longer standoff ranges. Why I like to go every couple of months is because tactics change. What becomes more important changes over time. The technology changes too. You're there one period. Here's how drones are used. Here's what's happening with artillery. You come back 3-4 months later. You see a different means of integration. You see different software being employed. You're seeing maybe one set of technologies now being increasingly countered and people shifting to another. And so it's very important to track these evolutions. For me, I think that this keeps you from extrapolating your views from wherever you are in any period of war, because these things can rapidly get stale. It's the only thing I can say to anybody watching this. In a large scale conventional war, things tend to evolve every couple of months. So you really have to stay with it. It's a constantly moving target. Oh, but and there's always a challenge for anybody that's writing long reports and somebody who's spent a lifetime of doing this. I share your pain because this is like you're writing a report on tactics and technology used in 1941 and it's going to come out halfway into the latter half of 1942. And then I'm going to ask you, how current do you think that's going to be? That's the story of most of reports and writing I see on drones and tech innovation in Ukraine.
Yeah, that's what I think is interesting too. Like there was when the FPV drones started coming out, I was like, I'm just learning what a Bayraktar is. You know, I don't even know what the hell you guys are talking about.
And you're way behind the curve, man. Bayraktar is 2020 in the Nagorno-Karabakh War. You're like the U.S. Army in the interwar period. All right, is mechanized vehicles going to pull horses to the battlefield, or should the other way around, or what is it?
It's just the chief of the horse cavalry when the tank's coming out. I think there was something you said, the fortifications thing. Why is it that you think, or why is it that the Ukrainians were behind on that? Was that an intentional decision because they wanted to keep moving forward? Was it because they didn't have the resources? Was it a mindset thing, like we're not going to dig in because it sends a bad signal?
Okay, so it was two things. First, the last point you mentioned, it was a mindset issue where Ukraine stays on the offensive. Yeah. So the view was Ukraine's not going to dig these lines or dig in because that would mean a hardening of the line. That means Ukraine isn't liberating any more territory, and it sends the wrong signal and the wrong message to the population, the troops, which I get. But when you've lost a strategic
initiative, is it a political or military decision?
I think it's much more a political decision. That's what I suspect. Although I have to be honest, I cannot say that with great certainty or confidence, but I think it was more a political decision. And I understand where it comes from, but I'll say that in terms of basic military pragmatism and necessity, when you've lost the initiative and when you're disadvantaged across the board on materiel, that's the time to start digging. And when you see that period coming, your own offensive is culminating. You're about to cede the initiative. You need to start putting shovel to the dirt because that's the best way to reduce your losses on the defense, right? And the best way to maximize the opponent's loss, especially when you have a munitions deficit. Entrenchments, fortifications work. By the way, you know what folks tend to have in common? Those that are not big fans of attrition's conversations, I often find also have a tendency to grossly underestimate the value of a prepared defense and overestimate how successfully a maneuverist approach with lots of integration, joint voodoo magic, right, simultaneity, how well that's going to overcome.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare.
That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
A series of overlapping minefields and entrenchments. And I will tell you, or the whole like, well, we'll just air power, we'll just do it. And
that's right.
And
the
question, but
I've been in armor. I'm an armor officer for a few more weeks, and I've been in units where I've had commanders that specifically say, like, we're not training the defense because we're the U.S. Army and we just do offense, you know. And I'm like, dude, come on now, you know. So I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah, it's true. And by the way, people that aren't that well trained in defense tend not to value defense either. It's an intellectual and a cultural thing, which is if you don't train for an effective prepared defense, you may not value a prepared defense as mustered by your opponent well either. So you may not. I'm just being frank about it. And to be clear, I want to circle back to this because I heard some kind of rather what I think incorrect opinions or myths about why the Ukrainian offensive failed. I've heard them time and time again from our own defense community. I want to come back to that, but I want to finish answering your question. The other reason for lack of defenses is a very boring explanation, but it's force structure. And I love to annoy people with force structure because most people like to talk about operational concepts and tactics. And I often like to talk about force structure first because force structure will often be deterministic of a kind of more deterministic of what happens and harder to change. Tactics is like, oh, this doesn't work. Let's do something else, right? Force structure doesn't work the same way. It's like, oh, we hit the delete button on armor in our service. Well, you're not going to get it back tomorrow. If it turns out that armor was important, I don't know what to tell you, but unlike tactics, that's not coming back into your force.
You're not going to see that for a decade.
Yeah. So, you know, that's one big thing that, as we talked before, Russian military made the wrong bets. They hit the delete button on infantry to a substantial extent and dramatically reduced the amount of infantry in their force. And boy, did that do them a disservice. That resulted in a lot of their problems early on in this war. Had an article on War on the Rocks in 2022 on Russian force structure called Not Built for Purpose for those who are interested and discuss this. It helps us answer the question, actually. If you reduce the size of your infantry squads and if you reduce infantry battalions to supporting infantry companies in tank regiments, and if you cut the amount of infantry together with cutting the level of readiness, the level of manning, right? And so you end up going from 100-man infantry company down to 76 on paper, down to 59 at your actual manning levels, and then most of them are stacking in this big, big you know, they're all mechanized infantry. You suddenly have no dismounts. Like, what are the downstream effects of doing that across a force? And the answer is we actually have a good sense now based on what happened in this war. And all I can tell you is I can highly suggest not doing that as a theory of how to manage the force. But
is that basically where the BTG originated to? I mean, is that where that came about?
No, so, okay, BTG, by the way, most things I see right in the BTG in our community is just plain wrong. Just absolutely wrong. Okay, we'll do a detour. If we have more time, let's do a quick detour on BTG.
I got all the time in the world, so.
Okay, I have, well, until about.
We'll do whatever time you got. Yeah.
All right, so first detour, and we'll come back to the force structure question. on force structure, reason why I couldn't do it is because unlike the Russian military, right, the Ukrainian military does not have a clear force structure above that of a brigade. No divisional, no combined arms army, no real corps structure except the two corps that were created for the offensive last year. On top of that, the other – but, okay, why is that important? Okay, you need somebody to manage the war effort and to be mm-hmm. thinking about who's going to build secondary lines, third lines, and structure of defense. That's usually done at that kind of core army level for not a front, but let's say an operational direction. The second mm-hmm. issue is, unlike the Russian military, Ukraine doesn't have dedicated engineering brigades. In the Russian military, there are dedicated engineering brigades that support combined arms armies. All they do is dig with specialized machine tools, right? They dig machine dug trenches, they cement them, they harden them. In typical maneuver brigade, you have an engineering battalion, but that battalion is going to prepare the defensive positions of that brigade, right? They're going to dig in the artillery, they're going to provide the positions for the infantry battalion. That's it. Now let me ask you, Amos, if that's what you have, whose job is it to dig secondary lines? Who has the capacity, the dedicated capacity, to dig three lines of defense, let's say, or to dig major fortifications and entrenchments if everybody's got five brigades and each brigade has an engineering battalion and those battalions are out there digging positions for their brigades? Who is behind them actually preparing an organized system of defense that goes back 20, 30 km? Well, it's first question, whose job is it? Is there a part of the force structure that does that? If there isn't, you know, it's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. Because if there's nobody who's thinking that way and isn't a part of the military dedication. Right. So very quickly, the answer is two parts. First is political, but the second one is structural. There isn't somebody in the forces that was looking at the map saying, hey, my job is actually to organize a system of defense and to build multiple lines of defense going back. Plus, you know, in order, it's not just about thinking about it. You have to get authorities because you're building it on your land. In Ukraine, commercial activity and farming takes place right near the front line. You'd be very surprised if I took you there. You know, there's a battlefield right here, and just like a little bit behind it, there's just a guy plowing a field. There he goes. He's just on his, you know, tractor working it. You want to build defenses across his property. Okay, well, you have to make sure that you have the regional administration on board, right? You're going to be doing all these things. So somebody's got to work through the authorities and work that part of the equation. Money has to be spent. Ukraine has plenty of capacity, right? That's to do it, but not necessarily in the Ukrainian, what we'll call a corps, but engineer troops, right? So that was part of the issue. Okay, now back to the BTG, because you opened the Pandora's box, and I want to address this. And I will not solve this for everyone at once on this discussion, but I'll do it because 99% of what I read about BTGs and the problem with BTGs.
You look like you're going to lose your mind.
You're just plain wrong. Yeah, people can't see it because I'm holding my head and I'm sure. Yeah. All right, here's the challenge. I'll explain. Why did the Russian military ever use BTGs? It was a force management construct. Okay, the Russian army has two significant qualifiers. The first is that it is partially a conscript army. It depended on a biennial draft each time, taking in around 130 to 125,000 troops, with a total of maybe 250,000, 260,000 troops or conscripts being taken in every year. Conscripts, by law, are not allowed to be used in war, okay, except in big time of mobilization, national defense, and are not seen as generally useful. They are meant to be primarily labor for a force, right? Free, cheap labor, because guess what? 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds cost nothing. That's part of the reason why the Russian military was slow to mechanize logistics, because if you have an annual free pool of 250,000 people who you can use as physical, as manual labor, you're going to be a lot lazier about automation and mechanization, like just intellectually, because 18-year-olds get brought to you every year, and you probably don't think that they're good for much besides moving ammo boxes around, right? No surprise. Okay, that's part one. Part two, it's a partial mobilization army with a decrement to readiness. And that readiness had declined in a bit in the years running up to the war because they kept expanding the force structure. So what they were going with is a dual force generation approach. In every maneuver formation, whether it is brigade or a regiment, part of a division, the idea behind the BTG is they could generate a predetermined battalion tactical group with contract staff personnel who are not conscripts, who cannot be used, okay, who would man these BTGs, and they would be able to generate two BTGs per brigade or regiment on short notice as a high readiness force. In the event of armed conflict and local war, the BTGs were meant for smaller scale contingencies on short notice and could be self-sustained for a period of conflict, let's say up to 10 days, plus some additional logistical support, but relatively short duration. So you would employ them in a war like a Russia-Georgia war. You would not employ them in a war like a, you know, Russia v. NATO. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The assumption for the rest of the force was that in the event of a regional or large-scale war, they would have something around 2 months' notice in the increase of tensions and all this, and they could begin mobilization either in advance or at the beginning of the period of war, fill the manning tables, and then they could deploy as divisions, regiments, and what have you. The purpose of BTGs was to get around the fact that a substantial percentage of the ground forces, because conscripts concentrate in the ground forces. Conscripts don't go to the Air Force or the Navy nearly as much. They end up in the ground force and the airborne. To get around the issue that you have a substantial power force or conscripts, and you're also operating in maybe 70-ish percent readiness relative to the overall staffing required for your force.
Yeah.
So you could do this on short notice, but they weren't meant to be employed in a war like the Russia-Ukraine war. The reason they were used that way is, of course, because the Russian leadership thought there would be no long, prolonged conventional war, that this was a special military operation. They'd take over Ukraine in a matter of weeks. Most of it would be decided early on. There wouldn't be a prolonged period of fighting or resistance, and they wouldn't have to deal with attrition, all these issues. So that force was very brittle. Like, we know that the Russian assumptions generally were that the main phase of combat operations would last somewhere, I think, between 6 to 8 weeks, but not much longer than that. And that's about what they, geared the operation towards. The reason I'm telling you a story. So basically, BTGs are failed concepts. They don't work for this or that reason. Okay, BTGs may not work. But to be clear, when we looked at the staffing level, we found that BTGs on average were smaller size formations and manpower than people anticipated. They averaged more like 600 personnel as opposed to 800. So the commander of the BTG actually wasn't managing that much in terms of people, to be perfectly honest. They weren't managing a force dramatically larger than a typical maneuver infantry battalion. But there was a lot of equipment and a lot of issues, I think, in terms of sustainment. Bottom line, I don't know if BTGs are a good idea, okay? And it showed that they're quite brittle and easily attrited. But what I do know is that most things people write about BTGs in terms of the origin of the idea, what they're meant for, how they were used, are wrong. They just are, okay? And BTGs were a force management construct designed to generate a force with these big structural issues for a particular type of short-nosed contingency, right? I don't know how the Russian military would have performed. Well, actually, increasingly, we do have a sense of how they might have performed with proper mobilization, filling out regiments that have many more kind of full kind of infantry battalions. We saw how they actually performed with that kind of force on the defense in 2023. And guess what? It looked very different from the way they looked in 2022.
I was just going to say, the idea wasn't used in the context in which it was designed accidentally because they performed so poorly at the beginning of the conflict and had, like you said, 2023, the idea was used a bit more in context because they had time to generate the force to build out what was the BTG. The interesting thing that I'd read, I don't know, it's been a while now, was Lester Grow and Charles Bartles, I think it was, had written that, and I forget where I read it. Yeah. I think it was reading something that they had written a while back, but it was that the BTG was an offshoot of the Chechen Wars, I believe, and it was almost like a counterinsurgency type formation also, where it was used to help quickly get forces into a counterinsurgency situation to overcome many of the same things that you pointed out there in terms of conscripts. Conscripts couldn't go, but they needed to get forces in quickly. And so it was a way to get combat forces in a place quickly.
Yeah, BTG's been with us for a very long time. The whole idea is you got a lot of force on paper. You got partial mobilization army with lower readiness. And how can you generate manpower and employ them in management in a more agile way and cobble together the better parts of your force, right? That BTG has been almost institution in the Russian military. I'm not saying it's a great solution to the problem, but you can't assess it if you have no idea what is the problem that the force is trying to manage and why this exists as a solution in the first place. And in cases where BTGs were used in a manner that kind of reflected what they were meant for, such as the, let's say, Russia-Georgia war, you can't say that they weren't effective, to be honest. Like they, in terms of performance relative to task in cases where they were used appropriately, I won't say they're ineffective. They're just completely inappropriate for this type of war, but that wasn't the idea behind them in the first place. Lastly, I'll say that the big issue that the Russian military also fell into in the run-up to 2022 is that the Russian Ministry of Defense got greedy. They kept expanding the force structure. And the question was, how are they expanding the force structure but without getting more manning into it? And what they were doing is they were cutting the actual size of the BTG in staffing by reducing the amount of infantry. And there's an issue you run into. As we know, strategies fail, in my mind, for two big reasons. There are many more, but I'll list two. First one is usually they're not strategies. They're just grocery shopping lists with the word strategy on top of them. And no actual choices are made. That's a lot of documents I read called strategy. But the second one is nobody does the things they said they were going to do. And the Russian military fell into the second trap, which is they had a clear theory why they were making the choices they were making in force design. And then they compromised on the theory, and then they didn't do the things that they said they were going to do. And they got greedy. They cut the readiness. They expanded the force structure. They didn't fill out with manning. They compromised by cutting the infantry. This made the BTGs themselves very brittle and missing a key part of the of one of the key combat arms. And, well, you saw how well it worked in the early days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Again, it goes back to the whole point of combined arms and the idea of, you know, tanks are great, but a tank without infantry helping protect its flanks and, you know, clear forward of it and clear the, you know, all the places that other infantrymen with AT systems can hide is a very dangerous thing. And that's, I think, a big reason you saw the, you know, the javelins and the in-laws and all those things so prevalent early on in the conflict. Mm-hmm. All right. Mike, anything else? I know we're short on time here and I don't want to chew up any more of your time. Anything else before we break here?
Yeah, so two things I want to hit on. If we haven't frustrated or caused a degree of consternation amongst everyone involved in discussions on defense strategy, military theory, there's two more points I want to tease out from that IISS piece that I did with Franz Stefan Gatti recently. And this was, we address these based on experience of this war. And remember, these are lessons or observations from this war that may not necessarily be applicable to contemporary modern warfare in general. We always have to be mindful of context. But first one we hit on a lot was air superiority, which, as I often say, is treated as talismanic in Western circles. But there are a lot of unstated assumptions about air power and long-range strikes that get to be baked into expectations of what you can achieve with it. We saw a lot of problems and challenges in this war that air power alone cannot solve, from drones to all sorts of extended defenses. And most importantly, the munitions challenge that you see for ground force is actually very significant for air power, particularly when it comes to PGMs. And you see that a war of the scale will very quickly empty people's magazine banks of their air-to-air and air-to-ground munitions. I've been in discussions with colleagues in other Western military who said, well, you know, this is primarily an artillery war. The West is placing much of its firepower into air power. I say, that's true, but you're actually much worse off on munitions available for air power than you would have been fighting even an artillery war, because many Western air forces have very neat capabilities and platforms, but not a lot of munitions for even basic air-to-air combat. This is issue one. The second one I wanted to raise, this is an important one. There have been multiple iterations of like the deep battle, and the most recent one I heard in the war a lot last year was fire control, and I came to a realization just from a lot of firsthand experience and observing the fighting there. I got to tell you guys, there's a lot of magical thinking and wish casting taking place on the deep battle and fire control. It is not a substitute for the close battle. Fire control, even at short ranges, does not exist as a real thing. Most of the battles in Ukraine have taken place with both sides starting off within 10 kilometers of each other and never being able to establish effective fire control over each other's positions. From the beginning of the fight or the offensive, at best intermittently contesting it. With FPV drones, people have been able to deny mobility in daytime. Up to the front, maybe forcing people to walk and hoof it the last 5-6 kilometers during day. But that's still, 10 to 15 kilometer stops, even less than that. Typical FPV drone distances around 10 km without retransmitters for the signal. The reason I'm saying all that is folks had this idea that I heard discuss about long-range precision fires. And I will tell you, for what they do, you'll be very impressed by what long-range precision fires cannot achieve in a war. Because they certainly do not give you fire control at ranges of 50, 70, 100 kilometers.
Yeah.
Opponents reorganize and adapt to their presence fairly quickly.
Oh, yeah.
They are then effectively countered if you look at the extent of deviation or neutralization of both our artillery PGMs and increasingly over time our long-range precision fires that were developed specifically for this purpose. You have to be very careful with these theories about what long-range precision strike is going to achieve. I'm not saying it's anything like ineffective. I always say capabilities have their greatest impact when they're first introduced at scale. And we saw that very much in this war too. But I want to be very clear that this war shows that doodling big range fire rings from your HIMARS systems on the map and saying that now we're going to have fire control, you don't have the persistence of visibility in ISR, you don't have the magazine depths to maintain consistent fire control. Maybe it could be done in a different context, but it certainly wasn't doable in this context. In this context, nobody has fire control barely 10 kilometers from the front line, let alone 50 or 70 or 100. And so it's important to just emphasize to people that the debal is an important component, right, of the fight. It is not a substitute for success in the close battle. If you do not have a successful offensive or breakthrough, the debal by itself isn't going to win much, okay? It is a useful component, of course, of a destruction-oriented approach, but it needs to be complementary to something, okay? Right. And so it is useful to making elements of an attritional approach work, but I want to make clear to folks that so far it's not appeared to be a war-winning strategy, and Ukraine has employed a lot of the best long-range strike capabilities available in the West in large numbers, from Storm Shadow air-launched cruise missiles to Gimlers, to now increasingly the new GLSDB, to other capabilities, to capabilities of its own. I can make a very long list here. And the point I'm just trying to make is this all has an impact, but don't think that this – don't have the techno-fetishist approach of debal substitute for getting the close battle right. Yeah, not to belabor that point, but this is a part of the piece as well, and talks about how these things have to complement each other. Rather than people thinking wishfully that one is really going to be the decisive way of fighting.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up. The talisman thing. I'm flipping through my PDF here, and I have that sentence highlighted there at the beginning of that paragraph. And I think it's somebody that beats the drum about the limitations of precision strike munitions and long range precision strike. I was happy to see that. That argument articulated in there. I've got a paper coming out anytime. It's in the last phases of publication with Rusi Journal on another aspect of this. Go ahead.
I was going to tell you, if I told you how low the effectiveness had become for things like Excalibur, artillery rounds, bonus, other systems, I would get beaten up. But I will say, based on how it started, it declined,
This is the thing that folks forget or don't realize is there's a narrative associated with a lot of this, which I understand and I get, and the narrative is intended to help advance other narratives, and that's fine, but you have to understand there's a narrative at work, and it's an information operation. But there is a severe, and again, like I come at this from a personal experience too, I saw the limitations of precision strike. Like I caught the last couple months of the Battle of Mosul, and like Mosul, you don't flatten a city because precision strike's working the way it's supposed to be, go ahead.
I was going to say, the part about is, of course, that look, not just because I don't want like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin to pull up to my house. by the end of this podcast discussion.
Yeah, knock on your door, they're gonna be like, excuse me, Mr. Kaufman, come with us, please.
Yeah, we have some, we want to talk about some things regarding your views about HIMARS performance and whatnot. But what I just wanted to say is that I don't think we're ragging on these because we're somehow don't think that precision strike is a key component or capability of a force. So make sure that folks are clear-eyed about how it's likely working in a war, the degree and how quickly it's likely to drive adaptations on your opponent's side, and then counters. I'll tell you, electronic warfare works. Electronic warfare works. It's a very significant factor in this war. And that this then will have to require significant adjustments, modifications to your systems, and further on evolution. And lastly, and this is for the, you know, thinking about kind of, you know, the next war, you have to remind, if you've already employed these technologies in a war against a particular opponent, and the maximum impact was realized when they were introduced, and they drove that cycle of adaptation, which it has in this war, people will then have a tendency to buy whatever they saw work in the last war they observed, right? So they run out and buy all the systems that worked. Like Ukrainians bought TB2 Bayraktars because they saw them working in the Nagorno-Karabakh war, and their effectiveness lasted 2 weeks.
Now you're talking about what I know.
Yep, that's what happens. They thought that was a, you know, I will tell you, I actually think that it worked for them in the first couple of days, but the effectiveness of TB2s very rapidly diminished and their impact. So the reason I'm saying this is just keep that in mind. These capabilities would have to be substantially evolved, upgraded, modified, and don't just go out and buy the stuff that you saw work in the last war thinking that it's going to work just as great against the very same opponent that has already faced these capabilities and adapted to them and experienced them on the battlefield. It's just a note of warning. Make sure you realize that the maximum benefit has already been monetized, right? It's already been realized in the fight.
Anything else before we go, Mike?
Look, not much on my end. Thanks for hosting me again. And sorry for some of my detours, if you want.
Terrific.
I'm happy to come back for the next iteration of this podcast. Everything you know about BTGs is wrong, and please stop writing papers about them. Also, to Army Publications FM that wrote about Russian tactics, you need to update the Orbat, and Uzbekistan is not in the Caspian Sea. Sorry to bring that up, but folks, just so you know, there are plenty of us available who are happy to volunteer to help you peer review these publications, okay, before you put them out.
That's good to know. I can tell you there's very little peer review going on in any of that. All right.
So, don't suffer in silence. I'm there. Chuck Bartles is there. You have a whole office in Kansas called Foreign Military Studies Office that belongs to the Army. You could even have them look at it. They specialize on Russian tactics and forces.
All that stuff's written at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, right next door to where Chuck Bartles and all those guys work. So
I'm just picturing all sorts of crazy stuff. All right, just my last saved round that I wanted to fire. That's it.
All right, cool. All right, thanks, Mike.
All right, take care.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We know that there are a lot of other podcasts competing for your time, and we appreciate you sharing your time with us. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you would share this podcast on social media, to include Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. Also, we would also appreciate it if you would give us a rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify Podcasts so that it makes us easier for new listeners to find. Thank you.